today on Against the Grain: class privilege, critical theory, environmental crisis. You might not expect weighty topics like these to be addressed in stories written by a science fiction and fantasy author. But Paul Park takes up these and many other issues in his new book, A City Made of Words. I'm CS. I'll talk with Park, the writer and senior lecturer in English at Williams College, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. To say that Paul Park is a science fiction and fantasy author is to leave out a whole lot. Yes, Park has written a number of critically acclaimed novels, including Soldiers of Paradise and A Princess of Romania, as well as a bevy of short stories. But Park is also an educator. He teaches English at Williams College, who infuses his stories with not only surrealism and surprising plot twists, but also ideas about where society and academia currently stand and might be headed. In one story in his new short story collection, A City Made of Words, one of the characters declares that the vocabulary of plot, character, setting, and the like is the language of class privilege. In another story, Park considers the passion with which people attach themselves to different schools of critical theory. These are stories to be both enjoyed and pondered, and I was happy to be joined in studio recently by Paul Park. I began by noting that the first story in his new collection, a story called A Short History of Science Fiction, begins with an epigraph, a quote from a short story by W.H. Rhodes with the title The Telescopic Eye. I asked Paul what makes this eye of a person, of a character named John Palmer, different or unique.
The quotation is from a story that a lot of people think of as a kind of a first starting point of American science fiction. And it's about a boy whose eyes are malformed so that while he's effectively blind, when he's with you, the only things that come into focus are things, say, in the solar system or on the surface of the moon. And he is able to observe the people who live on the moon with great exactitude.
Right. So when he's born, his parents think he's blind, but at some point it becomes clear that he can only see at extremely long distances.
That's correct.
And you're saying, because this is dated 1876, so, and you know, sometimes epigraphs are not related to real people or texts, but this is a real text published in 1876 by, again, W.H. Rhodes. So this was a You're saying this sort of launched, would you say it launched science fiction in a certain way?
Well, in the United States, there's sort of it's considered a starting point for American science fiction. You know, if you can think of science fiction earlier, as you have sort of two main strains. There was a kind of a social commentary, social satire strain, and a boy's adventure fiction strain. If you could imagine that one is sort of is a kind of a Jules Verne way of writing, and the other is a kind of an H.G. Wells way of writing. This is an American strain, which is at its beginning more a sort of a boy's adventure fiction strain. I think the earliest American science fiction, I think in the 1860s, there were a series of books called The Steam Man of the Plain. I think it was about a steam-powered robot that was kind of a cowboy or something like that. So this is later than that, but really quite early in the field.
A lot of this story seems to be about what we believe, what we want to believe, maybe how gullible we are. And here I'm thinking of John telling the narrator that he'd been taken by beings from another planet back to their planet, and the narrator is listening to this eagerly, and then at some point saying, you know, you're lying to me, but then wanting to hear more. How important is this issue of believability in stories about people having, you know, unusual attributes or having otherworldly experiences?
Well, I guess for a lot of science fiction readers, they're drawn into the genre and drawn into reading science fiction often when they're young, with a certain type of credulity. You know, they like to imagine that all this is possible. You know, going to the stars is possible. They might know in one part of their brain that, yes, it'll take 10,000 years to get to the nearest planet, but they're not just thinking, oh, this is a thought experiment. They're thinking, oh, this is something that might actually really happen sometime. And part of their response to it comes from that, even though often as they grow older, they have another part of them that puts a damper on that. So I wanted to show a narrator who both had, because he's grown up now and because he's had some experiences that were difficult, he doesn't want to be credible in the same way that he was as he was a little boy, but he sort of can't help it. He sort of can't help being pulled in again and trying to imagine this, because visually, as it's described, it's so compelling. I remember my grandfather telling me that he had seen a lecture by Percival Lowell about people living on Mars, and sort of this was presented in the early part of the 20th century, not as some crazy idea, like a Edgar Rice Burroughs idea, but some kind of logical fact or scientific fact, and being so astonished by that and going out and trying to find Mars on in the night sky and thinking, yes, there are canals, there are cities there, abandoned cities, and how astonishing that was to think about that as cold fact. And I wanted to sort of recapture some of that, especially as a way of pulling somebody away from their own experience, which has some dire attributes.
One of the characters in another of your stories says that science fiction stories usually carry an unusual burden of exposition, and they usually include either an overt or implied thesis, often one of each. So that's what your character says. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that particular story, I tried to make it work as a model of what the character is talking about. So he's talking about trying to find a way of writing essays or describing intellectual ideas in a form that borrows from fiction writing. As it happens, you know, when I teach my own students expository writing, that is essay writing, often I ask them to look at short stories and say, well, look, okay, so this person has a lot of exposition they have to get through to make the story make sense. What are the techniques that this person uses? Or this person has a very clear political idea that they want to express. How is it that they make it so that that is palatable to the reader? How do they seduce the reader into agreeing with them? And in fiction, often those are more varied and more subtle and more compelling techniques than in your ordinary essay writing. So in this particular case, I wanted to model something that was functioned both as a story and as something with a thesis. And so simultaneously, that's the thesis of the story, but also something a character is saying.
Fair to say that in fantasy and science fiction, you know, you're presenting another world to some degree, or an unusual set of circumstances, and so that the exposition has to be of a certain length or detail in order to be convincing to the reader in a way that maybe, you know, other kinds of fiction, you know, it wouldn't require that kind of exposition.
Yes, and it's interesting to see how different writers sort of deal with that. But yes, indeed, if one of the things you're trying to do is establish a location for your story. You know, in some sense, all stories work like this. You make a little model of the world, and you have little imitation people walking around the model, and then you say, let's look at this model, and maybe we can notice things that are happening here that we can't see in the world around us because it's too big. In science fiction or fantasy, the model we've made is distorted in various ways. And one of the things that the reader has to do is figure out the ways in which it is different from our world. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that in most science fiction stories, implicitly, there's some kind of political idea just in the way that the location differs from our location. You know, you go 50 years in the future, and if everybody's under 12 feet of water, even if the story is not even remotely like that, there's an implicit kind of political thing you're saying. Or if everything's dry as a bone, that's another thing that you're saying that's implicit in the location. The way fantasy works, which is essentially or often looking backwards, you know, you have these various faux medieval, say, locations. There's another kind of implied political message just from the retro nature of that, the way it sort of turns away from a future and sort of focuses on the past as if it were somehow the future.
And you've written both kinds of fiction. What do you like more, to investigate something that might be tinged with nostalgia, or be rooted in something that we might all remember or might have heard of in mythical terms, or create a world, you know, that we've really never been exposed to, that's alien to us, that we might want to imagine or participate in?
I prefer that. I prefer the latter. I don't like the idea of setting stories in a place that depends a lot on this kind of shared mythic sense of some imagined past that is so different from what any student of history would recognize as the real past. I much prefer, even if I use sort of fantasy tropes, to find ways of reimagining them or reinventing them so I turn them into something new that feels new. You know, a lot of successful science fiction and fantasy, it works on two levels. It works in that it satisfies two very different and conflicting desires. And one is to be shown something completely new, or some experience that nobody has ever actually lived through, and at the same time that will feel familiar to them, often in the relationships between the characters or the overall kind of emotional setting. And I think it's easier for me to try to accomplish those two things if I make up a location that is mine alone and doesn't depend on this kind of shared mythos.
Paul Park is my guest in studio. He's the author of many novels and short stories. His new book, a short story collection, is called A City Made of Words. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. A lot of your stories in this collection feature a kind of, in my opinion, a kind of a radical break, that things are proceeding, and there might be an uncanny aspect to what's going on, but proceeding kind of in something that I might think is quite realistic, and then at some point there's a rupture and you realize that something else is happening that might be called surreal or supernatural or science fiction-y. Can you talk about that? Is that something that you find important, is to break with a reader's expectation at a certain point in the narrative?
Yeah, I think these stories are largely new, but they also have been chosen by the press, PM Press, and by my editor to stand alone as essentially a series of stories that connect with the same strategy. So it's not a coincidence that many of them feature this particular aspect that you identified. Yeah, I think there are a couple of ways of getting into a counterfactual story. And the first is to set up immediately that we're in a different place with different expectations. But certainly another way is to play more with the reader's assumptions and to guess, because readers are smart. So you give them something and you guess the assumptions they're going to make from that. And then you try to manipulate those things. And when you get to the point where the plot that they anticipate is going to start to unroll, you go, you know what, let's move this over to the right somehow. And now you can do the same process again and see if you can project again how you think this is going to go. And then when you get to that dividing point, you go, not quite. And then So that it's just a strategy of writing. And it's interesting to me, especially since lately I've been writing a lot of metafiction, and that metafiction sort of uses that as well.
Right. So metafiction, your bio page on PM Press's website, your bio page says that readers have followed you into the limits and possibilities of metafictional narrative. So what is metafictional narrative?
I guess it's a narrative, it's a story that's aware of itself being a story, aware of itself being artificial. So, you know, most stories in some sense, yes, you know that you're hearing a narrative, and in some sense, none of these things have ever happened. These people are made up and invented, but the power of the fiction comes from this illusion that you're pulled in and say, oh my gosh, my boy in this story, I hope a bad thing doesn't happen to him. Oh, my girl, this is looking terrible. Oh, I'm really happy we got over that obstacle. And that you get an emotional response to that as if you were following the adventures of some real person who the story could go either way. Metafiction is constantly reminding you that you're reading a story. And the task then is to figure out a way of making it so, nevertheless, you still respond to it in this emotional way. But it's a different type of emotion, because you're always being reminded, or after a certain point, after the metafictional break, you're reminded that there's no illusion of reality here. There is just a text. And what you're really reading is, you know, black marks on paper.
So can you give me a concrete example of that? It might be a tale in this collection. Because, I feel like we've been talking, I've been encouraging you to talk in a kind of abstract level about a lot of things, conceptual level about a lot of things. But what would be like a concrete example of a plot you've written that features this metafictional way of telling a story?
Okay, so I wrote a metafictional novel not that long ago called All Those Vanished Engines. And the way it starts is there's a young girl in Petersburg, Virginia, and she's writing a story that is kind of a memoir. It's as if we, as we start the story, are reading her diary, and she says that she sort of writes in it every night, and then we see different entries in it. But then gradually the events of the diary turn away from the events of her life, and we think, oh, well, she's making stuff up now because we've observed her life and it's not really like this. But then those events take on a life of their own, and that story starts to develop. And then somebody in that story, a sort of a transposition of her that we have originally thought, part of the way she's doing this is imagining herself in this other location with adventures that are happening to a false her. That little girl starts to write a diary as well, and her diary is the original story. So at that moment, that takes us by surprise. And at that moment, we think, well, what's the real narrative and what's the commentary? And you can go back and forth. And in fact, the whole story, the controlling idea was that Escher, famous Escher print that you have of drawing hands, where one hand is drawing the other. You both have pencils and one hand is drawing the other. So that section in the novel goes back and forth between these two stories, and you don't know which one is the real story and which one is the commentary of the story on the story. So that would be an example of metafiction.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Paul Park joins me. He's a science fiction and fantasy author. His novels include All Those Vanished Engines and Soldiers of Paradise and A Princess of Romania. And his new book, which is a collection of short stories, is called A City Made of Words. Paul also teaches English at Williams College. What you said reminds me a little bit of the last story in this collection, which is called, I believe, Creative Nonfiction. And there is an 18-year-old girl in a private high school, and she's in a creative nonfiction course taught by this teacher. and she is writing a story that she presents to him, right? It's kind of a writing assignment. And it turns out that the plot parallels what's really going on to the discomfort, to the really strong discomfort of the teacher. So how much of the plot can you share with us, and kind of what made you think of presenting this or writing this?
So that story is about a terrible person. The teacher is a terrible person, and predatory and violent in various ways. And there's a level on what I'm interested in stories sometimes where you can think of them as counterfactual if you wanted to, or you could think of them in some sense as a realistic story also if you wanted to. So the counterfactual aspect of it might be that, yes, in his class, he has discovered an 18-year-old girl who, in her writing, in her creative nonfiction, is foreseeing his own future and in some sense, you know, driving the events of his life. But you could also imagine it that he's sort of prey to certain types of demons, and he is looking for a way to justify various bad things that he wants to do by taking the agency away from himself and giving that agency to this young woman. So there, that's the serious aspect. Now, there is an aspect that I wanted to make humorous, which is just the discomfort of correcting a manuscript and grading a manuscript and making suggestions about a manuscript that, in fact, is then manifesting itself in your own life. And so you have to really be careful, you know, because you can't get this girl mad, for example, because you'll see the results. So it came out of that, you know. So I'm a teacher, and some of these stories are about teacher-students relationships. And often the starting off point is something that, you know, is a version of something that some dynamic that I have experienced or recognize, and then I find some way to make it hyperbolic.
You have a lot of opinions about what's going on in academia, and some of them come out in this book, not only in an interview you did with Terry Bisson, also a noted author, but also in your stories, in a couple of your stories. So, for example, in one of your short stories, there is an English teacher professor who's being kind of interrogated. He says that the vocabulary of plot, idea, character, voice, setting, and so on, that this is the language of class privilege. Why does he say that, or why do you have him saying that?
So I teach in a college that is prestigious and expensive. Privileged students go there. I'm very much aware of how it is that old academic structures and ideas about how things should be organized and taught collude in the perpetuation of systems of privilege. And I can see that in the teaching of creative writing, and I can also see that in the ordinary sort of English department curriculum. And it works kind of differently in each case. But in that case, I was thinking more about the creative writing, the way creative writing is taught in privileged institutions, which feels to me that it valorizes and protects the writing of privileged students from private schools, students who have been exposed to certain types of realistic writing in high school. And then when they get to college and they have to apply to oversubscribed creative writing classes, they are the ones who are selected because they already have this head start. And then they perpetuate a certain type of writing because that's what they've been rewarded for doing. And that there's a language, there's an assumption about the way stories should be written that sort of comes down from the Iowa School and Raymond Carver and writers like that, that naturally privileges the American upper middle class, that they that it, it requires a lot of self-confidence of a certain type when you're 19 or 20 years old to write in this particular way that will be then praised and get you into this narrow gate of creative writing classes.
And this type of writing, beyond the self-confidence with which it is enacted, features what in terms of mechanics or style?
Well, it means, you know, the various cliches of modern writing or modernist writing, you know, write what you know, show, don't tell, find your own voice, that these this is the natural vocabulary of a certain type of student, and but not all students, and that when you know, in a more diverse landscape, people from a diversity of intellectual backgrounds come together, if those sort of touchstones of how writing should progress are your assumptions, you're always going to end up with a certain type of student. And that I think that's at a certain point unconscionable.
Paul Park, the author of many novels and short stories, and his new short story collection is A City Made of Words. We'll take a short break and speak more with Paul about the book and about his writing. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Paul Park joins me in studio, and he teaches English at Williams College. His new book is a short story collection. It's called A City Made of Words. Okay, so you were talking about some of the kind of the writing lessons that a lot of people are exposed to, such as show, don't tell, and write what you know. So let's just talk about those two in particular. Write what you know. That seems pretty obvious. Show, don't tell, by which I assume you mean that you are not going to tell the reader what the, say, a character is feeling, but you are going to express that by showing the character doing certain things such that it's clear that the character is feeling what he or she is feeling. So is that correct? And what's wrong with these verities, these concepts that, you know, are the basis of a lot of writing instruction?
Well, I think write what you know. The people who are going to really respond to that and knock those exercises out of the park are the people who are already used to thinking of their lives as a source of drama and power and something that you can make narrative out of. So when I say self-confidence, it's not just in the use of language, it's in the idea that you can take your own experience and make something that you feel good about drawing people's attention to it and saying, oh, this is me, respond to me. And show, don't tell, I'm less sure about my objections to that. Certainly as a science fiction writer, I reject a sort of binary there. And I think that skillful writers they move effortlessly back and forth between showing and telling. And often you tell one thing and then you show something different. And the dramatic tension comes from the gap between those two things. But it tends to privilege a way of writing that is, you might call it minimalist realism, where it's simple and bald in its writing, and it is describing events as they happen and the movement of objects through space and people as they speak. And again, I think that's not a bad primer for writing, but if you say, okay, well, that's the highest model and that's what we're really looking for, especially with young writers, you exclude a lot of people, especially people who have, say, a lot of urgent political things that they want to say or social things that they want to say. It privileges, I think, a way of writing that takes at its basic assumptions the world as the student finds it, which is often a kind of an upper middle class environment. And if you want to break out of that and say, no, you know, those aren't our assumptions about what's important, what's happening, what are the themes of writing for 18, 19, 20, 21 year olds, often that requires breaking away from show, don't tell, because there are things that you want to tell.
Do you think political writing on the part of students at that age, this university introductory writing, creative writing course type level, do you think political writing is kind of discouraged or looked down upon?
Yes, very much so. And that's unfortunate, especially it's unfortunate in a privileged environment like the college I teach in, where marginalized students are struggling to find a voice. And it's hard for them to find a voice in the constraints of that kind of writing.
Because it's not seen as literary, as writing literature?
Yes, it's not seen as writing literature. It's seen as argumentative. It's seen as taking us out of the shared consensual reality that the students are actually in. And you can see this over and over again. You know, the basic locus of creative writing is an undergraduate workshop, and in a privileged environment, it's going to be much easier for them to talk about the shared experiences of privileged young people. And so that somebody is trying to break into that from the outside and they have some other story that they've written about, you know, let's say they have a family in Nigeria and they go visit them and they're writing that, or the story takes place in a location that's very, very different from most of their peers, they can't get a lot of help for that. You will see in a workshop like that, unless the leader of the workshop is very, very skilled, people shut up. You know, they don't feel that they can help with stories that are outside of this particular locus that they're comfortable with.
Let's talk about another story in this collection, A City Made of Words, again by my guest, Paul Park, A Resistance to Theory. Now, this is, in a sense, a lot of fun. Modern critical theory is the subject of the story in a big way. And maybe we ought to begin there. Is there any way to sort of define or encapsulate the term critical theory?
That's a hard, long answer. Encapsulate, no, because it sort of goes through phases. But I guess the through line would be the search for meaning in literature has to be interrogated. And they're sort of, we started with various assumptions about meaning that we have to observe and think about at every step, because we're missing something about the way literature operates.
Well, can you talk more about that? Like what, how might critical theorists try to undermine our traditional ways of reading literature? And then What's the extent of your interest in it, such that you decided to revolve a story and characters around it?
Well, so I guess it starts with thinking about literature as you have a writer, and the writer has a message or a theme or something that's very important to them. And your job as a reader is to figure out what that message is. And you can do that in all kinds of different ways. But at a certain point, people are sick of that. And also they think that's a really small category of the kinds of things that you can say about a work of literature. And in fact, it sort of goes against the experience of a lot of writers, even, because usually when you start to work on something, or certainly I'm thinking about myself, I don't have those themes. I don't have that message. You know, occasionally I'll write a whole story and then I'll say, well, people like themes and messages. So you know what? Here I am at the end of the story and I'm going to put something in a Christmas present and I'm going to look under my feet and I'm going to dig a hole and I'm going to put it down on the hole and I'm going to tamp it down because I know people like to get to the end of the story and dig it up and open it and see what's in there. But that's an artificial thing. So there's a limit there. So then if you reject that as a model, then you sort of reject the idea that you're even interested or it's necessary or important to imagine what the intention of the writer is. And your job as a critic is no longer to figure out what that is or even say whether you would agree with that or disagree with that or respond to it at all. And then it becomes some other kind of thing. You're looking at the text in a completely different way. Often what that turns into is more something that has to do with you than it does with the text itself. You know, the meaning then you find is something that is generated out of your own way of looking at something. And that can be powerful too, because after all, there's a way in which that's always been the experience of most readers. But then, you know, so you get that. So if on some level, that's a kind of a structuralist reading, and then you get later into deconstruction, which is essentially, well, that's just another way of, you know, finding transcendent meaning in something. It just comes from a different source, but it's the same kind of thing. And what do you know, didn't we want to just break that apart entirely and think of a different way of examining literature? And then let's say we wanted to reject those readings as well, then what are we left with?
So in the story, you have a grad student, and she is apparently an adherent of Judith Butler, the world-renowned theorist based at UC Berkeley. And she is intent, it seems to be her mission, to go and find people posing as critical theorists, but who she sees as kind of not being real. I think she uses the word weeds. They have to be rooted out because they are contaminating the field, the true field of critical theory. So what did you like about that idea of having this woman who wanted to really kind of confront a critical theorist in this story and then have a rather wild and unusual and very interesting aftermath?
Well, I think anybody who's read a lot of critical theory can find themselves going crazy a bit just because it's so complicated and so hard to, at a certain point, figure out what you think is actually true. There's a lot of the discourse that encourages you to question basic ideas of why people think things are true or where belief comes from, or what kinds of interpretations are valid and what kinds of interpretations are specious, because the discourse itself emphasizes for us how slippery and difficult these distinctions are and how subjective they are. So I think it's easy to lose your way, and I tried to make that funny, where you're constantly buffeted by doubts about, you know, you you come to texts and you look at these texts and you try to figure out what they mean and you try to grab hold of them and they resist you, and at certain moments they seem to take on a life of their own. And so that was part of it. And the other part of it was I found it really fun to try to parody different types of critical theory, you know, to try to take something that maybe at the beginning might seem like a legitimate paragraph of political theory and just go wild on it. So by the end of it, it sounded like a parody.
I'm CS. My guest is Paul Park, and he's written many novels and short stories. His novels include Sugar Rain and Celestis and The Tourmaline. He's written three collections of short stories, If Lions Could Speak and Other Stories, and the new collection that we're talking about today. It's called A City Made of Words. It's published by PM Press. So we haven't really talked much about your process. How do you, well, first of all, is there a typical way or ways in which ideas for stories and novels come to you, and how you then turn them into plots, into narratives?
Yeah, so that moment of that story where the protagonist, with some hyperbole, rejects concepts like plot, character, tone, all these, this vocabulary that's grown up around talking about how to write. That comes a little bit out of my own experience, because I tend not to plan things out like that. Or if I do, it's fairly late in the process. And I often start with things that are hard to find a vocabulary for, but I guess it's more likely that I have a visual image. And it's hard often to identify where that comes from, but it generates itself in me, and there's often an event or an action. It's often a matter of light, and I can see sort of lighting effects of different types. People aren't necessarily even involved, or any kind of plot or narrative structure, and there's sometimes a mood I can see. You know, something could be melancholy or violent or happy or pensive or something like that. And all that is extremely inchoate. And then if I think, okay, well, this is presenting itself in some kind of urgent way, how do I find a vocabulary for this? How do I find a way to make this into a narrative? You know, you have the feeling that if I were a musician, I would have a different set of strategies, or if I were a poet or a watercolorist, I'd have a different set of strategies. But as a fiction writer, what I'm stuck with is plot and character and dialogue and action. And I have to sort of pull back from the moment of genesis, the visual moment of genesis, or the mood, to figure out a way of generating that feeling artificially through the actions of invented people. So it often starts that way. So that's very different from saying, oh, I have a theme, I have a idea that I want to express. It doesn't feel that way at all. So, you know, because I don't know what it feels like for other writers, but any language that suggests that I have some kind of message I want to express seems very wrong to me. That doesn't mean I don't think that I can superimpose that stuff later, or that I think it's not the way you should write or anything like that. It's just that the story doesn't come from that place where I say, oh, I have identified something, say, as unjust, or I've identified something as wrong, and I want to correct that. It comes from some other more private place and more sensory place than that. And then when I'm trying to put together an artificial structure to it, sometimes I can layer those things in.
You've been characterized as being on the humanist wing of American science fiction. What is the humanist wing?
Yeah, well, the key there is the passive voice has been characterized by. That's not something I reject, because humanism sounds like a good thing, but but it's not necessarily where I would place myself. My guess is that what that means to people is that the stories are about emotions and relationships more than they are about technical scientific ideas or projections in the future of technological trends, which is a completely valid way to write, but it's true, it's not really my way.
So I think in kind of every story in this A City Made of Words, this book, this short story collection, things take a kind of surreal turn. And you once told, I think, another interviewer that to present a world without surrealist aspects is as distorted as presenting one without humor or love. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think in our culture, we're having a kind of a science fiction moment. So it's not as easy, I think, to categorize science fiction by its nature as non-realistic genre literature. And you can see that many top-flight writers are now interested in it. Katsuo Ishiguro, all kinds of people. And I think that's because a lot of people are imagining that realism is somehow not entirely up to the task of capturing this particular political, emotional, environmental moment, and that the constraints of realism are as artificial as anything else. So that's loosened things up a bit. So I guess that's the only thing I mean. I mean that people might look at a way of writing stories from 20, 30 years ago that were perfectly adequate or even more than adequate of the expression of their emotional and cultural and social lives. And it doesn't feel like that same vocabulary works entirely well anymore. And you need some kind of surreal or counterfactual or a layer to the narrative, because that corresponds to our own experience. I mean, you know, independent of what you might think of the ethics of our current political moment, there's a way in which it feels entirely surreal.
Surrealism aplenty in Paul Park's new book, A City Made of Words. It's a collection of short stories. He's a science fiction and fantasy writer, the author of many novels and short stories, and he is also a senior lecturer in English at Williams College. Paul, wonderful talking to you. Congratulations on your book, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And in poking around for something to fill out the rest of today's program, I came across what might be considered a bit of science fiction history. Philip K. Dick wrote a short story called Colony in 1953. That story was adapted for radio in 1956 and presented on a program called X-1. Here's an excerpt of that adaptation, which aired on October 10th, 1956.
In the biology section lab, Major Lawrence Hall continued to examine tissue samples from lower fauna and flora samples brought in from Planet Blue. He settled a container of prepared slides and flipped the switch on the electron microscope. Major Hall slid the first slide on the stage of the microscope and adjusted the focus knob.
Come on, come on, come on. There you are. All right, come on, kid, eat something.
The microorganisms, a form of rotifer, displayed none of the characteristics of ferocity and aggression which were normal on several dozen other planets. Presently, however, Major Hall stopped whistling. Inasmuch as the two eyepieces of his microscope twisted suddenly around his windpipe and started to strangle him.
Ooh.
Paul tore it, but they dug relentlessly into his throat, steel prongs closing like the claws of a trap. With a convulsive effort, he managed to break free and fling the microscope from him.
Oh, that's crazy. It's better let go of my leg.
He kicked the microscope loose and drew his blaster. As the microscope scuttled away, rolling on its coarse adjustment knobs, he fired. The microscope disappeared in a cloud of metallic particles. The plans board of the research team was assembled in the officer's library. Commander Stella Morrison was outlining plans on a detailed aerial survey map.
This long, flat area is ideal for the actual city. It has an adequate watershed in the hills here, and weather conditions vary sufficiently to give the settlers something to talk about. There are large deposits of various minerals. The colonists can set up their own factories. They won't have to do any importing. Over here is the biggest forest on the planet. If they have any sense, they'll leave it, but if they want to make newspapers out of it, that's not our concern. Now, all reports are in except bio, and I think that before long we'll be getting...
Stop.
Major Hall, may I remind you that when the consul is in session, no one is permitted to interrupt...
Come to my lab.
Look, Hall, if you're not feeling well, you look a little sick.
Yes, well, I should be. My microscope just tried to strangle me.
Oh? Oh, I see.
It almost got me, but I blasted it. But that's not the worst.
It isn't?
No. The microscope is still there. After I blasted it, I found it under the lab bench, untouched.
Look, Major, you sure you don't need a psych test?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it does sound a little...
You look post-trauma to me.
Huh? Oh. Maybe you're right. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Commander.
Put Major Hall on psycho report. I think we'll have to proceed to order colonization here without him.
Portions of a radio treatment of Philip K. Dick's short story, Colony, which aired on the program X-1 in 1956. I came across this in a Pacifica Radio Archives documentary, which revolved around an interview with Dick conducted by Mike Hodel, host of the program Hour 25 on Pacifica Radio Station KPFK in Los Angeles. The interview took place in 1976. And the reason the excerpt you just heard was presented is that it illustrated a point Dick was trying to make, that a lot of science fiction writing hadn't, by the mid-1970s, progressed in any significant way beyond what Dick was writing in the 1950s. Philip K. Dick's novels include The Man in the High Castle, A Scanner Darkly, and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, upon which the 1982 film Blade Runner, directed by Ridley Scott, was based. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.